Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Friday, May 1st, 2020, Section A. Less than 1% of Midlanders have been tested. DHHS. 1.1% of people statewide have been tested for coronavirus. By Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE at MRT.com. A shortage of novel coronavirus testing swabs nationwide has led to limitations on who can be tested for the virus. In Midland, 1,608 samples have been taken by Midland Memorial Hospital, which has the city's only drive-through testing site. Out of a population of 176,000, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, this translates to about 0.9% of the population who have been tested for the coronavirus. Statewide, the percentage of people tested is 1.1%, according to the Department of Health and Human Services, making Midland on par with testing in Texas as a whole. The City of Midland Health Department has reported 76 confirmed cases. As 6 of those patients have died, there are 70 residents known to have recovered or are recovering from the virus and be expected to have immunity, 0.04% of the population, though experts are divided on if immunity exists and if it does, how long it might last. As restaurants and stores get set to reopen today, the Reporter-Telegram asked MMH Chief Medical Officer Dr. Larry Wilson if he believes enough of the population has immunity to the virus. He said national data indicates more people have COVID-19 than have tested positive for the virus. Unfortunately, we can't assume the positive antibody test indicates immunity, he said. But based upon larger testing areas in like New York and elsewhere, over 20% of the population that had not been recognized to have had the virus tested positive for an immune response. Wilson said that it's unclear if an immune system response, which produces the antibodies detectable in blood samples, actually indicates that a person is protected from future COVID-19 infections. Antibody testing can determine who has had the virus, but the level of antibodies a person might have varies from person to person. With research on the disease ongoing, there's no consensus among the scientific community about what level of antibodies could equate to immunity. Studies on other coronaviruses have found that immunity tends to persist for a few years before waning, but further research is needed to determine if that holds true for COVID-19, according to an April report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Still, Wilson said it would be helpful to have testing, and specifically antibody testing, more widely available. It would be nice to have more testing done, but we have been limited on availability and turnaround time, he said, regarding testing for active coronavirus cases. Midland Memorial Hospital began testing antibody testing this week through their direct access testing group. Wilson said during Thursday's Unified Command Team meeting that he does support some businesses beginning to reopen if residents maintain social distancing precautions. If we do this wisely, maintain social distancing, use masks to help promote social distancing, if we do all those things, we can start getting closer together, start doing more things, having activity in the economy in a safe way. I really think we can move that way. It's the new normal. Church members use online giving during pandemic. By J.C. Lewis, jacy.lewis at hearstmp.com. Some Midlanders continue to tithe even though in-person church services have been temporarily canceled. First Baptist Church of Midland senior pastor Darren Wood said that the church started doing online giving about 4 or 5 years ago, and it wasn't an issue for their congregation because a lot has been doing bank drafts already. By introducing it as a bigger scale thing, we were just joining where everybody else was, he said. I mean, my wife and I probably wrote 50 checks last year, total for the whole year. People just don't use checks like they used to. He said that during the pandemic and economic downturn, the church has had donations stay stable. We're on even ground, he said. Sunday is what I would have expected it to be if we had been in person. We've been really blessed at that point. I know that's not true for everybody. Wood said they are on track concerning their budget for the year. He said the church isn't falling back or roaring ahead, but they are holding where they are. We are under no delusions, Wood said. We know things are about to change with the double whammy of the virus and the collapse of oil prices. It's going to hit here first, so internally we've said it might not look like this in 3 months or even in 3 weeks, so let's be wise about our spending. First Baptist Church of Midland is continuing to make sure needs are met in the community, Wood said. We've got a strong partnership with the West Texas Food Bank, the Midland Soup Kitchen, Breaking Bread, and the partnership with MISD to provide bags for kids to take home, which has been continued out of our doors here. We want to let people know that the church was never made to be a fortress. We need to be a hospital for those who are hurting. First Baptist Church of Midland recently donated to RIP Medical Debt to eradicate medical debt for families in the Permian Basin. Brian Pinson, Minister of Missions, said they decided to contribute to RIP Medical Debt in December before the pandemic and oil crash. There are some former debt collectors that decided to use their knowledge and expertise for good, so they founded this nonprofit to help philanthropic, other nonprofits, and churches to buy and forgive medical debt of people around the country. He said Wood had heard about it from one of his contacts at another church who had donated. First Baptist Church of Midland started looking at the program in December, and the money was supposed to be dispensed in February. However, it was delayed because RIP Medical Debt was purchasing more debt. First Baptist Church of Midland's contribution went through the week before Easter. This was money set aside at the end of last year to invest in our local community. That was the same source of money, and we have done this in other ways with other nonprofits as well. We thought that this was a great idea. Pinson said medical debt is such a millstone around people's necks with credit ratings while trying to buy a house or a car. Most people don't choose to have medical debt. It's because of an accident or because of circumstances that are beyond people's control. So this was a great way to help the community and share the love of Christ in a practical way. The church was able to eradicate $8.5 million in medical debt. Pinson said they were able to help more than 2,800 households in Midland County alone. We don't know their names because HIPAA rules, he said. We don't know who they are, but they received a letter stating that this had been done on their behalf in partnership with RIP Medical Debt and First Baptist Church of Midland. Pinson said First Baptist has always helped with rent and utility assistance, and that need will continue in a greater way because of current circumstances. Mercedes Rossi, Director of Stewardship and Development for the Catholic Diocese of San Angelo, said the diocese has been helping smaller parishes that don't have online giving options. Right now, if you went to sanangelodiocese.org and went to our COVID-19 response page, on that page, there is an online donation form where anybody can select their parish. All parishes are listed, even those that do have online giving. Parishes can continue to give money physically by mailing or dropping it off according to their parish rules. She said online donations have continued to grow since they started the online giving program on March 17th. We've seen an awesome response from parishioners in terms of those who are still capable of giving. They have really responded during this pandemic, knowing that their churches are really in need. The average online gift right now is actually more than what we would see in a traditional weekly tithe. She said that is a testament to their parishioners and their willingness to give. Parishes that are experiencing the benefits of the online giving platform the diocese has set up want to set up online giving at the parish level. She said that giving online might be a shift of mindset for some people in different generations. As someone who has modernized my whole schedule Everything I do is on my computer or on my phone, she said. It's a way for me to make giving more visual, rather than feeling distant to the parish through online giving. I feel more connected because I know and see that donation is coming out of my checkbook every week. I think sometimes we forget the use of a physical check requires distance as well, because who knows when that money is going to come out of my checking account. She said, for being a nonprofit organization, parishes are receiving a lot of support, and at least 60% of regular collections are still coming in during this time. All of this is done with a great sensitivity to the fact that a lot of people are struggling right now. We realize that a lot of people are unable to contribute like they would regularly because of the coronavirus, but also because of what's happening in the oil field right now. First and foremost, we're checking on parishioners to make sure that they're okay, to see what they need. Stonegate Fellowship Executive Pastor Larry Gilbert said that God has been unbelievably gracious during this time, and the church is doing fine from a donation standpoint. We are watching our expenses with the idea that not just COVID, but the economy and the problems that besets. The church will be implementing programs to help their families. Our body will be receiving some information specifically about the different avenues and different programs that are available to them to be able to access during this time.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm going to be reading a segment from the front page of today's Midland Reporter Telegram. What's open? Retail stores, restaurants, movie theaters, malls, museums, libraries, churches, and other places of worship. Note, check with specific locations. Not all businesses will choose to open today. Capacity operating. Businesses will be allowed to operate at 25% capacity. Governor Greg Abbott said the expansion to 50% could happen in as little as 2 weeks. What's not open yet? Gyms, salons, tattoo shops. Grocery store hours. Effective today, Friday, Market Street and Albertsons Markets will return to regular store hours. Albertsons, 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. Market Street, 6 a.m. to midnight. HEB, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Walmart, 7 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. Some store updates. JCPenney will open two stores in Texas on Friday at Fairview, north of Dallas, and in San Antonio, according to the Dallas Morning News. The Dallas Morning News report also states JCPenney has 10 Texas stores open for curbside service. Best Buy says it will keep offering only curbside shopping in Texas, according to the Morning News report. In early May, it will allow customers into about 200 stores by appointment only, but Best Buy hasn't discussed the location of those stores. Quotable about opening today. Dr. Larry Wilson, Chief Medical Officer for Midland Health. I think it's the right move. I think that we've moved in a measured, thoughtful way. You've heard me say this before, and I'll continue to say it. If we do this wisely, maintain social distancing, use the mask to help promote social distancing, washing our hands frequently, using antiseptic cleanser on your hands after touching. If we do all those things, we can start getting closer together, start doing more things, having activity in the economy in the safe manner. And I think we can really move that way. It is the new normal. Midland Mayor Patrick Payton. And so really, one of the easiest ways to answer the majority of questions related to us opening up is hearkening back to what you have been told from Midland Health. We have all been talking about from Midland Health on down, which is continuing to practice social distancing, to continue to practice the personal hygiene practices we've been talking about, and to not treat this weekend as if it's July 4th week, Memorial Day weekend, or tax-free weekend. And we're all going to get out and do everything. But we need to continue to just be careful about opening up, and we need to be paying attention to our retailers and to our restaurants that are paying particular attention to our safety, to the safety of one another as we go through this process, and also realizing this is phase one of the process with the governor. Question about Big Spring. Why is Howard County opening at a 50% occupancy rate? Howard County meets certain standards set by the governor, including having 5 or fewer active coronavirus cases as verified by the Texas Department of State Health Services. Compiled by Stuart Doreen.
USGS records 2 quakes northwest of Pecos, from staff reports. The U.S. Geological Survey recorded a pair of earthquakes early Thursday morning northwest of Pecos. A 3.2 magnitude quake took place at 12:24 a.m. about 0.6 miles south of southwest of Loving, New Mexico. The USGS said the depth was 3.1 miles. A second tremor was recorded 44.7 miles south-southwest of Loving at 1:27 a.m. The 2.4 magnitude quake also had a depth of 3.1 miles. The USGS reported 4 earthquakes, including Thursday's, in the last 7 days. The most recent was recorded Monday near Odessa. The 2.4 earthquake took place at 9:16 p.m. A quake with a magnitude of 2.5 to 5.4 is often felt, but only causes minor damage, according to the EPSACE, an educational site for seismologists. FWS petition to list dunes Lydgard as endangered, by Mella McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. The Little Dunes sagebrush lizard that calls the Shinnery Oak habitat in West Texas and southeast New Mexico home may still find its way on the endangered species list. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agreed Thursday to decide by June 30th whether or not to accept a petition from the Defenders of Wildlife and Center for Biological Diversity to list the lizard as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. The move comes after the two organizations sued the service for failing to act on their petition filed in May 2018, as required under the ESA. If the FWS accepts the petition, it will kick off a 1-year review to determine whether the lizard should, in fact, be listed. The Permian Basin has been the fastest-growing oil play the last 5 to 10 years, and both the dunes sagebrush lizard and lesser prairie chicken should have been protected to ensure they didn't lose so much habitat they go extinct, Noah Greenwald, endangered species director with the Center for Biological Diversity, told the Reporter Telegram. But that hasn't happened because the political power of the oil and gas industry to overrule science. Though the lizard has been a candidate for listing since 1982, the FWS didn't propose listing it as an endangered until 2010, kicking off a furious effort led by the oil and gas industry to prevent it. After putting together a conservation plan and a pledging of millions of dollars and thousands of acres of lizard habitat to the plan, the FWS in 2012 declined to list the lizard. The conservation plan was scrapped by current Texas Comptroller Glenn Hagar in December 2018, and a new plan has yet to be approved by the FWS. Peyton, residents need to be told what to do, by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HearstNP.com. The mayors of Midland and Odessa told residents Thursday during a special virtual press conference that the plan for today isn't much different than the last 2 weeks. There will be no 25% patrols, making spot visits to businesses, making sure they stay under 25% of capacity. There will be no heavy-handed government action to push residents toward a specific action. And finally, according to Midland Mayor Patrick Peyton and Odessa Mayor David Turner, there will be trust that residents of the two cities will practice the social distancing and best practices of a community that hasn't been dealt with in an inordinate amount of coronavirus cases. That trust, they said, isn't necessarily in place elsewhere. They don't have citizenship like we do, that says, listen, if you're not looking out for my safety, then I'm not going to patronize your business, Peyton said. So we're going to do what we've done, and what we have done over the last 6 weeks has proven effective. Payton said he expects there will be Midlanders who go to social media to tell officials who's not obeying the rules, so we're able to chase some things down and find some places where people are operating outside of the rules. But we're not going to be on patrol up and down the streets, going in and out and taking head counts. We just want to look for people, especially, who are not paying attention to the safety of their customers as well as our citizens. Our two cities have proven they don't need us to tell them what to do. They just need us to inform them what's important to do, and they'll usually do the right thing. The city of Midland reported 3 new confirmed cases on Thursday, which brings the total during the pandemic to 79. Ector County had 78 confirmed cases and 3 probable heading into Thursday, according to the Texas Department of State Health Services. Both trail other West Texas counties, such as El Paso, 887, Lubbock, 516, Potter, 499, Taylor, 291, and Randall, 213. Ector and Midland ranked 40th and 42nd in confirmed cases across the state. And according to Turner, it wasn't just the total number of cases, but better ratios of those testing positive compared to the sheer number of tests. Turner said in Odessa, 1 person for every 17 tested was a positive case. In Amarillo, it was 1 of every 6. Our citizens have been very, very good about watching what's going on, Turner said, and we're going to trust them. Medical Center Lodge addresses health crisis, from staff reports. Midland Medical Lodge has been called a hotspot for coronavirus in Midland County. On Thursday, officials from the lodge offered a first comment to the Reporter-Telegram about the number of confirmed cases at the North Midland facility. Midland Health Department officials reported Thursday that the number of residents who have tested positive for COVID-19 is up to 27, and the number of staff members is 6. 10 of those live in Midland County. The 37 confirmed cases equate to 46.8% of the total cases inside Midland County. At least 4 of the 6 deaths inside Midland County that were as a result of the confirmed coronavirus cases involved residents at Midland Medical Lodge, 3 females and 1 male. The following is a statement from an administrator with Midland Medical Lodge, which is located in North Midland. Foursquare Healthcare out of Dallas operates Midland Medical Lodge, according to its website. Midland Medical Lodge is continuing to work closely with the Midland County Health Authorities, Midland County Memorial Hospital, and our medical director staff to meet the needs of our residents and staff during this health crisis, Administrator Carrie Powell wrote in an email. We continue to follow the guidelines provided and updated by the CDC, Health and Human Services, and the Midland Health Department. Testing administration and test results are managed by the Midland Health Department for all local health care providers. Questions regarding testing should be directed to them. We are greatly appreciative of the community's support and for the unwavering dedication of our valued caregivers who are on the front line of caring for our residents. The opinion page. Guest view from the San Antonio Express News. Trump needs to quit with medical commentary. When the histories of coronavirus are written, including how the U.S. government responded, few areas will be examined more closely than President Donald Trump's leadership. Early in this crisis, he downplayed COVID-19, saying in January, "We have it under control." In February, he said, "I think when we get into April, in the warmer weather, that has a very negative effect on that and that type of a virus. So let's see what happens, but I think it's going to work out fine." In March, he said, "Just stay calm. It will go away." And then in April, he said, "And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute. 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning?" This comment spurred widespread rebuke as manufacturers of disinfectants rushed to put out statements telling people not to inject or ingest their products. The president's supporters have said this is not what he meant, but this misses the point. Why is he even wading into these speculative, unsupported, bizarre, and dangerous waters? Whatever the president's intent, the comment was stunning and extremely dangerous if someone tries to do this, but also fitting with a larger pattern. Remember, as governors and public health experts have pleaded for more ventilators, testing, and personal protective equipment throughout this crisis, the president has also oversold hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine. Beginning in March, Trump began to repeatedly hawk the supposed COVID-19 curing powers of the anti-malarial drugs, despite an absence of tests to determine their effectiveness and potential harm. "What do you have to lose?" he asked during one of his briefings. The American Medical Association's JAMA Network Open published a report on Friday saying researchers in Brazil cut short a study of chloroquine as a potential treatment for COVID-19 after nearly 24 patients died from daily doses. That same day, the truncated study forced the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to warn against the use of the two drugs because of serious heart rhythm problems in patients with COVID-19. Roughly 1 million Americans have been infected by the virus, and that's just the official count. And we've already lost more than 50,000 lives in this country. In times of crisis, we turn to our presidents for leadership, uplift, confidence, vision, and guidance. Not this. We will celebrate a proven treatment for COVID-19 and a vaccine. But the president needs to drop the medical musings and let the experts speak about treatments and ongoing research. He has the largest platform in the world, which is exactly why he cannot be so reckless with his words. Obituaries and death notices. It is with great sadness that the family of Berta Lopez Carrasco announces her passing on Thursday, April 23rd at Memorial Hospital. She was 79 years old. Due to the coronavirus, the family has decided there will not be a viewing or burial for safety concerns. She was born on March 20th, 1941, to Josefina and Ignacio Lopez in Mexico. She will be greatly missed by her husband, Leonardo, and the rest of her family. She is preceded in death by her parents and several brothers and sisters and her son, Jose Little Joe Granado. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home and Crematory. George F. Freddie Watt III, 72, formerly of Big Spring, passed away on Wednesday, April 29th, surrounded by his family in Midland. Services are pending due to current restrictions with COVID-19 at Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Paul Manuel Olguin, 39, of Midland, passed away on Monday, April 27th. Family will have a memorial service at a later date. Arrangements were made with Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. He is survived by his son, Paul Jacob Olguin, his mother, one sister, and numerous cousins.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Friday, May 1st, 2020. Section A. Safety First. Daycare Center Opening to Medical Staff by Ruth Campbell. Weeks after announcing it, Ector County ISD will begin offering daycare for the local medical community at Zavala Elementary School starting May 6th. A walkthrough for the facility was held for media Thursday. The operation will serve children ages 0 to 13, but in two separate areas of the campus, located at 1201 Clifford Street. The ultimate capacity is 306, but for now it is starting with 32 students. Assistant Superintendent of Student and School Support, Alicia Siverson, said. The daycare center will run through June 26th. Siverson said ECISD is excited to provide this opportunity to the medical community. We know how important this time is for them to be able to go to work every day and not worry about their children being taken care of. They serve us daily, and this is our opportunity to serve them as well. So we're just excited about providing this opportunity, Syverson added. The goal was to serve the medical community first. We will continue to add staff as the need grows, and that need would also include opening up to first responders. Right now, we are only staffed for the students that we have collected intake packets for, and that's 32 children, Syverson said. She added that she couldn't say enough about the help State Representative Brooks Landgraf, Republican Odessa, provided. He was very instrumental in helping get this off the ground just by removing barriers for us. We're very, very thankful to the support he was able to give, Syverson said. Paula Danheim, director of daycare and assistant principal at Hayes STEAM Academy, said everyone will be given gloves and masks when they enter the daycare center. Everybody is expected to wear at least the mask all day while they're in the facility. If they choose not to wear the gloves, then they have to continually wash their hands and disinfect, Danheim said. The students are expected to have parent-provided masks. Every room will have 9 students and 1 adult, Danheim said. The campus has a license for 140 children age 0 to 10 during normal school operations, and Center Director Sylvia Duran said the school usually serves children of teen mothers and ECISD staff. ECISD schools are closed due to the coronavirus pandemic. Due to the school closure, the normal operation has also ceased. Once we are no longer needed to provide services for the hospital employees, then of course we will go back to our regular operation, Duran said. Everyone is on board and ready to start. She added that it will be staffed by 18 people to begin with, and if needed, it will increase to 86. Danheim said everyone who will be working at Zavala is volunteering. The cafeteria will be used as one play area, and the toys are socially distanced. Students will get breakfast, lunch, and an afternoon snack. Duran said the students will eat in their classrooms. Danheim said social distance will be maintained with 9 children and 1 adult per classroom. At this point, the facility will be open from 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. There are 2 custodians on a shift in the morning, and they will disinfect. And once the morning ends, they will disinfect everything that was used and the classrooms. Then there are 3 custodians in the evening who will do the same. We've got things, manipulatives and different things for the morning and different things for afternoon. And in between, they'll be disinfecting, Danheim said. She added that the district is ready to serve the community. We're happy to support our healthcare workers, she said. Medical Center Health System President and CEO Russell Tippin said it's important for everyone to support each other during these uncertain times. We are thankful to have a school district that leads by example in times of need to show they not only care for the needs of their students, but of the entire Permian Basin community. This partnership allows our healthcare workers peace of mind, knowing their children are being well taken care of as they help battle COVID-19, Tippin said in an email. As of early afternoon Thursday, the Ector County website said there were 78 confirmed cases of coronavirus, and 3 additional ones are probable, bringing the total to 81. Duran said the county has not met the curve yet, so once the county does that, I'm sure we'll hit capacity. There will be 3 hours of instruction so students can work on material from their home campus. Every campus typically has 3 or 4 computers, so students will be able to use those and are allowed to bring a device from home. Then when mom and dad get off work, they're not having to go home and do homework. It's already taken care of, so we're trying to support them in that way also. I know that's been a huge issue with them working long hours and then having to go home and help with homework. So we're hoping to relieve that burden as well, Danheim said. We've also got PE, music, and art fit into the schedule, Danheim said. There will be a lot of outside play with sidewalk chalk. The PE coach at this campus was happy to open up her storage closet and let us have access to all of the PE equipment if we needed it. Then after every class rotates through that PE, they'll wipe down the supplies. Aaron Riddell, assistant principal at Zavala, said there are some things planned for the older children. For example, we have a garden area that they can actually garden and do some fun stuff. It's not going to be structured like a regular school day, Riddell said. Like the other ECISD campuses, Zavala teachers have been teaching remotely. All our teachers are heavily into Google Meets. They meet with their students twice a day on Google Meets. They have a morning session and an afternoon session, Riddell said. She added that this form of teaching is new to most of the teachers, but they have embraced it. They desperately miss their kids. They would rather be in the classroom teaching with them there, Riddell said. Syverson said they want the daycare service to be fun but safe. We want this to feel as much like a camp as possible and hopefully take the kids' minds off the things they're experiencing at home as well with their parents on the front lines. We want this to be a positive experience. She added that they will have access to certified nursing assistants to serve students' health needs. If we see a need for any of our counselors and our social workers are always available to help students, families, and our community, Syverson said. The number to reach a counselor is 456-HELP. That's 456-4357. MCH opens more surgeries. By Michael Merlo. Medical Center Hospital Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Timmons said that the next phase of MCH reopening will be Monday, which will open up some more elective surgeries. Those are cases maybe like pain management injections, cyst removals, carpal tunnel releases, just some of those simpler procedures that we can get in and out of our OR, so that will open us up running all of those rooms in our OR on our main campus, she said. Timmons added that MCH will still keep the outpatient surgery center closed for the time being. County Commissioner Eddie Shelton said that out of 1,173 tests, the county has confirmed 78 positives with 3 probable, 58 recovered, and 4 deaths. MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin reported that out of 707 tests, MCH has had 51 positives. 3 are in the hospital and 1 is in the CCU. He said that there are 636 negatives with 20 pending and there are no suspects in the hospital. Odessa Regional Medical Center President Stacy Brown said that out of 289 tests, 13 have been positive, 263 negative, and 13 are pending. That positive case number has not increased for us since April 21st, and we've almost doubled testing since that time. On that day, we had 148 that we've tested, and we're now at 289, she said. ORMC Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohith Saravanan spoke on some of the new priorities of COVID testing that changed on the CDC recommendations from April 27th. He said the new priorities for testing are listed as high priority or priority. We do want to increase the amount of testing that we're doing personally, generally, so we can first get a sense of what our community prevalence is like and try to capture the individuals that could have the disease early enough so that we can keep the incidence as low as possible so we can prevent the spread, he said. Saravanan said that the high priority are the hospitalized patients, the healthcare workers, people living in congregate settings, people with a lot of medical conditions, and people in a public health cluster. He said that the regular priority patients have two additions. One is the addition of different symptoms, and a second is an addition of asymptomatic individuals that public health has determined is important to test because they fall within a certain group, for example, that has been identified to be at higher risk. Along with symptoms like fever, cough, shortness of breath, Saravanan said that the CDC has added five more symptoms for COVID-19, including chills, muscle aches, new loss of taste or smell, vomiting and diarrhea, and sore throat. There are eight symptoms now that would qualify you to get tested, he said. We have now started to flatten the curve throughout the nation. We can expand testing to include more of those people who could potentially have been COVID that would not have fallen in a priority before. Dr. Timothy Benton said that there have been 119 calls for the drive-through testing, and 33 people have been scheduled to get a test. He added that the criteria for testing has not fully been changed, but they had already updated the symptoms list. The drive-through testing reportedly tested 13 people Thursday. Tippin said that for people interested in getting tested for COVID-19 by the National Guard, mobile testing should call 512-883-2400 for screening. The mobile testing will be from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday at the Ector County Coliseum. People interested can start calling for screening Friday, Tippin said, and it will be free to be tested. AG resists city's efforts to obstruct records access. City of Odessa wants OA lawsuit moved to Travis County by Laura Dennis. The Texas Attorney General's office filed a motion this week to deny the City of Odessa's request that the AG defend the city's position in a lawsuit brought by the Odessa American over the city's practice of not releasing public information related to crime. The filing in the 161st District Court of Judge John Smith asks the court to deny permissive joinder on the grounds that the OA is not accusing the AG's office of failing to release public records, as the OA alleges that the city has done, but is taking issue with the city's actions and repeated violations of the Texas Public Information Act by redacting information from crime reports that is public, and also by causing delays in the release of information. The City of Odessa hired an Austin law firm and in its own filing also requested that the court transfer the entire case to Travis County, where the Attorney General's office is located. The case cannot be transferred unless the judge grants the joinder. Attorney John Bushin, a media law specialist and counsel for the OA, said the City of Odessa's attempt to move the trial and to get the AG's office involved on their behalf should fail. The upshot of the Attorney General's message in its filing is that the AG wants no part in the city's scheme to use the Attorney General's office as an excuse for refusing to release public records, Bushin said via phone. He said the city's attempt to beg the Attorney General to be party to the lawsuit, essentially by suing the AG in a third-party action, is unprecedented in Texas public records enforcement cases. The Attorney General is saying, I don't want any part of that. The summary of the argument the AG makes is that the AG's office has sovereign immunity to deny the city's request to join them in fighting off the lawsuit, because that doctrine prohibits the city from suing the Attorney General in this setting. The AG's office also argues in its motion that the city's attempt to bring the AG into the lawsuit does not satisfy the basic rules of Texas state court procedure. Although the city claims the OA's complaint is with the Attorney General and not the city, the OA specifically alleges that the city violated the PIA by failing to promptly release public information and by unreasonably redacting public information after unreasonable delay. The OA originally filed the lawsuit in January to force the city to release public crime records in a timely manner and in accordance with state law. The AG's filing also supports the OA's response this week to the city's motion. The OA concluded its response by describing the city's motion as another groundless maneuver to obstruct and delay the OA's access to records that have always been open to the public and press. Prior to the filing, for months, the OA had battled the city to provide public documents to both the OA and the public that includes police reports and probable cause affidavits in a timely manner without redacting information that has always been considered public information under Texas law. The city abruptly changed the traditional practice of releasing public crime information following the Odessa mass shooting, August 31st, 2019, that resulted in the deaths of 7 people and the wounding of 25 others. Police reports from that shooting that were requested in the days following the incident were only released in late January. It was after the shootings that the city began to demand freedom of information requests for all probable cause affidavits and police reports, which the OA and its media partner CBS 7 argue violates the Texas Public Information Act, TPIA. Information that is always considered public does not require an FOI request, certainly not information that is covered under the TPIA. The change by the city resulted in reports on basic crimes being delayed by days or weeks, and often with large portions of the reports blacked out. In the past, the Odessa American received requested police records from the municipal court and not the city attorney's office, and often had those records in a few hours, unredacted. The city attorney announced that no records would be released until they were vetted by lawyers for the city. In February, state and national newspaper associations, as well as the country's largest newspaper chain, signaled support of the OA's lawsuit. The Texas Press Association and America's Newspapers, which represents more than 1,000 daily and weekly digital and print newspapers, recently issued strong statements of support of the OA's most recent legal action against the city. Also, Gannett, owner of the Austin American Statesman, the El Paso Times, and 6 other daily Texas newspapers, offered their support, as did the Texas Press Association. COVID-19 news. by the numbers. Ector County confirmed cases 78. Ector County negative 1,044 out of 1,173 tested, with 51 pending. 4 deaths. Midland County, 79 confirmed out of 1,648 tested, 6 deaths. Texas, 28,087 confirmed with 330,300 tested. Total Texas deaths, 782. U.S. cases, 1,031,659 total confirmed and 60,057 deaths. Find out more at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. Telehealth. The Medical Center Hospital, ProCare, primary care physicians, and specialists are continuing to provide care during the COVID-19 pandemic through telehealth visits. This allows established and new patients to visit with a doctor from the comfort of their own homes. Patients can connect directly with a provider from their smartphone, computer, or tablet. Simply call one of our MCH ProCare offices to schedule an appointment. For a list of providers, they can also visit procareodessa.com/find-a-physician or call 640-6468 for more information. Medical Center Health System and MCH ProCare want the community to know we are here for the community during these uncertain times, and that we are dedicated to continue making sure West Texans are treated and taken care of. Quick hits. Mall reopens. Music City Mall will reopen Friday, May 1st from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., Monday through Saturdays, and noon to 6 p.m. Sundays. The mall's ice rink will be open, but playgrounds will be closed. Music City Mall has also reportedly increased its normal cleaning program, which includes regular deep clean with approved disinfectants. That cleaning will be done more frequently. The mall was thoroughly cleaned during its closure. There will also be hand sanitizing stations spread throughout the mall. Permian Basin Regional Council on Drug and Alcohol Abuse continues prevention campaign virtually by Ruth Campbell. Staff at the variety of Permian Basin Regional Council on Drug and Alcohol Abuse, PRCADA, are usually out in the schools talking to students about the dangerous legal and illegal substances. Now they have to make the same presentations through platforms like Zoom. Michael Tarango, Public Relations Coordinator for the Prevention Resource Center, which is under PRCADA, said the students are now a captive audience. They've really got nowhere else to go, so we've kind of got their full attention. Hopefully they're all staying safe and staying at home. So long as the target audience gets access to this meeting, they're going to get all that information, Tarango said. The Prevention Resource Center in Region 9 is continuing its campaign focused on drug and alcohol prevention and awareness in West Texas. The goal of the Know the Facts, Know the Consequences campaign is to inform the West Texas community about drug and alcohol use in the area. The aim is to inspire change through awareness and partner resources. In April, the campaign is focusing on the explosion of the use of e-cigarettes by West Texas teens. A recent regional needs assessment found that almost half of all 12th graders in West Texas have used an e-cigarette. Only 54% of West Texas teens think e-cigarettes are harmful. 34% of West Texas high school students think e-cigarettes are not very dangerous or dangerous at all. A recent national report by the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, found that approximately 3 million high school students used e-cigarettes in 2018. That was a 78% increase from the previous year, a news release said. One in five high school students use e-cigarettes, and 30% of teen e-cigarette users start smoking regular cigarettes within 3 months, the release said. According to the CDC, the use of e-cigarettes is unsafe for kids, teens, and young adults. Most e-cigarettes contain nicotine, which is highly addictive and can harm adolescent brain development, which continues into the early to mid-20s. E-cigarettes can contain other harmful substances besides nicotine, the release said. Tarango said, the times he's been to some of the high schools, students don't see e-cigarette use as a big deal. But Tarango said the Prevention Resource Center wants to reduce their use and give them as much education about e-cigarettes, vaping, and tobacco as possible so they can make an informed decision on whether they want to try it or not. The objective is that they want to get teenagers not to try the substances at all. But kids will be kids, teens will be teens, students will be students, Tarango said. Sometimes they're more curious than others. One of the biggest things that we hear whenever we were able to go into the schools was nobody tells us anything. It's kind of like just say no, or we're feeding them numbers and stats, he added. But if they show the students the consequences of tobacco, it can make a difference. He said they had a pair of pig lungs that had damage and tumors from smoking, and another that was healthy. That's kind of what we focus on, is giving them real-world consequences, showing them that it can mess up your mouth, it can mess up your lungs, it can mess up your brain, Tarango said. He added that this tends to work better than giving them statistics. With being stuck at home, I'm sure kids get restless. Teens get restless, Tarango said. Students who would be bored at school are going to get bored at home, stuck inside. They figure they can watch TV or play video games instead of doing schoolwork. There's prescription medication around the house. I'm sure there's alcohol in the home. I'm sure students have parents who smoke, whether it's e-cigarettes, marijuana, or traditional tobacco products. It's all going to be right there in their face. So whether or not their access is going to increase, I wouldn't be able to say, because like I say, that's information that's just so real time, there's not really a way for us to report on it yet. But the temptation is there, so we can only assume that if it's going to be in their face, they may want to try it a little bit more, Tarango said. Melissa Brenham, Director of Prevention Programs at the Permian Basin Regional Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse, said the virtual presentations are going really well. We've been able to reach quite a different audience. Sometimes when we have to go into the school district, we're either presenting to this group of teachers or this group of nurses or just the administration or just the Student Health Advisory Council, SHAC, committee. So doing it this way, we're bringing it to them and it's their choice to join in and log on. We've had a lot of teachers. We've had a lot of counselors on. We are doing the presentations that we would typically present to a junior high student, Brenham said. The virtual approach has allowed PRCADA and its programs to bring prevention into the home. The whole message behind it is to get parents to start having conversations with their kids about drugs, alcohol, tobacco. We're trying to give them, the parents, tips and tools also about how to start the conversation, she said. She thinks this is something the organization will continue offering. We record every one of them, and we'll post them on our social media. It's not just about substance use. It's staying healthy, giving families more positive alternatives to where drugs aren't in the picture. We're still able to provide parents with information on where they can get help. Those services haven't stopped. It's just a little different on how to access them, Brenham said. When PRCADA representatives talk about prevention, parents ask what their role is. She added that the youth program and community coalition plant the seed on prevention. It's really up to the community and to our educators, to our school district, to our parents, ultimately, to kind of water them, Brenham said. All we're doing is implementing and giving information and planting the seed of prevention. She added that data drives the organization's message. Some youngsters like to get statistics, and others relate to the pig lungs. When you say 1 in 3 of you will become whatever, then they start listening. So we kind of have to lay it out in a different way. Data can be fun. We've just got to be creative with it. That's what the PRC does. They focus on that data delivery of making sure everybody understands it. But yes, the campaign that they're running, know the facts, know the consequences. If we can change the facts, then we can change the consequences among our youth. That campaign right now is really youth-focused and sort of to get the attention of the adults, Brenham said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.